Good afternoon. I'm Dr. Elliot Sussman, the president and CEO of Lehigh Valley Hospital and Health Network. I'd like to welcome all of you, and particularly our special guest. I also want to make a special welcome to our colleagues who are viewing this from over in our auditorium at Cedar Crest, our auditorium at Lehigh Valley Hospital Muhlenberg in Bethlehem, and in downtown Allentown at the 17th Street campus. We are privileged to have with us today Senator John McCain. A word or two about Senator McCain. Senator McCain, as many of you know, graduated from the U.S. Naval Academy. He then served 22 years as a naval aviator, and he then also participated in the Vietnam War, came back, served two terms, beginning in 1982 in the U.S. House of Representatives, and then in 1986 was elected to the U.S. Senate. And today he visits us as the presumptive Republican nominee for President of the United States of America. We've got three different parts of our program. We're going to hear in just a moment or two from Senator McCain in terms of health policy issues that he is very concerned about. We'll then do a bit of a lecture, and we're going to share with the senator and with all of you some clinical vignettes of how we use healthcare technology to care for our patients. And then we'll have plenty of time where the senator will take questions from the audience. Senator McCain, we're honored to have you with us, an American patriot, a distinguished representative, and senator. Welcome to the Lehigh Valley and Lehigh Valley Hospital.
Thank you very much, Dr. Sussman. Thank you very much, Doctor, and thank you for your kind welcome. And I just, before I make any other comment except that I'm honored to be in the company of American heroes, people who devote countless hours and countless effort and love and affection on people who are needing help of their help, especially in trying and difficult times. So I'm proud to be in the company of the wonderful people who are here at Lehigh Valley Hospital. And I might add that you are a tribute to modern medicine and a striking example of the power of innovation. But the real strength here is Dr. Sussman and Dr. Swinford would all agree, I'm sure, is the people. The people are here who have literally dedicated their lives to helping others, and I'm honored to be in your company, and I thank you. I've had a wonderful time touring the American healthcare system so far this week, and I'm honored to be here. On Monday, I was at Children's Hospital in Miami, where technology allowed an infant born with a complex congenital heart disease, a tiny infant, to survive and strive, and a vigorous young boy to survive an awful accident. Medical professionals developed surgical procedures to correct bilateral cleft, and our medical device industries invent innovative breathing support. Yesterday, I toured the Moffitt Cancer Research Center in Tampa, where they're making dramatic progress in the fight against cancer. With skill, ingenuity, and perseverance, they're turning new technologies against one of the oldest enemies of humanity. And I know you never lose sight of the fact that you're each involved in one of the great vocations, doing some of the great work that there is to be done in this world. My friends, any serious discussion of healthcare should recognize that for all the strengths of our healthcare system, we know right now that it falls far short of the ideal. Underlying the many things that trouble our healthcare system are the fundamental problems of cost and access and innovation that will be at the heart of providing better care at lower cost for every American. Innovation, as I'm going to see, and you know, is the wellspring that will bring us new treatments, better information, and put families in charge of their health care. An important part of the landscape of health care is the treatment of chronic conditions. We can make tremendous improvements in the cost of treating chronic disease by using modern information technology to collect information on the practice patterns, costs, and effectiveness of physicians. By simply documenting and disseminating information on best practices, we can eliminate those costly practices that don't yield corresponding value. But it'll take modern information technology to produce these insights into high-value care, and the same technology to allow ready and cheap access by families who need to know their options. We also know from experience that coordinated care offers better quality and can cost less. We should pay a single bill for high-quality disease care, not an endless series of bills for pre-surgical tests and visits, hospitalization and surgery, and follow-up tests, drugs, and office visits. Innovation of new treatments, as we are about to see, as I am about to learn, the adaptation of new technologies to reach patients and improvements in the design of workplaces will, as we all know, improve the quality of care. Paying for coordinated care means that every single provider is now united in being responsive to the needs of a single person, the patient. Health information technology will flourish because the market will demand it. In the course of my campaign, we will have a much-needed healthcare discussion. It's much needed across this nation. I believe we can strengthen our system if we put families in charge, harness better information and competition to control costs, and to provide the right incentives for the power of innovation to make our lives better. I'm pleased to see this innovation that's on display today and look forward to learning more about it and then responding in any questions or comments or insults that you might have. Thank you. It's wonderful to be here. Thank you very much. Thank you, Doc.
Right here for a second. Senator, thank you. You'll see in just a few moments how we do embrace technology and innovation, and particularly how we use information. So we're going to take you on a tour of our innovations, and I'm going to introduce Dr. Ron Swinford as our tour guide this afternoon as we, in fact, go through three different important medical innovations with you.
If you'd join me over here, Senator McCain. We only had a brief moment to speak with Senator McCain before we came in, and he emphasized to us that he truly is on a journey of learning, that he's here to understand the healthcare system better and what's going on, and particularly innovation that's going on in healthcare. And we think we have more than our share of innovation, and we want to share that with Senator McCain. First, I'd like to introduce you, Senator McCain, to Mary Joyce Robinson. Mrs. Robinson is a patient of ours who, unfortunately, after Thanksgiving last year, learned that she had ovarian cancer. First step, of course, in the treatment of cancer is the surgical step, and she underwent a 7-hour procedure that was a multidisciplinary team led by Dr. Martin Martino, a gynecologic oncologist, and assisted with some of the OBGYN residents, such as Fonda Campbell, who's with us here today also. And in the care of this complex patient, she has also had chemotherapy since then, underwent her 6th and final round of chemotherapy last Wednesday. It's been doing well, as you can see. And so I'd like to have Dr. Martino share with you how we've harnessed technology to assist in her care.
Thank you, Ron. And good afternoon, Senator McCain. From the moment I first met Mary at our remote office in Scranton, our team used the latest technology to help follow her through her course. My clinical notes from our first visit were uploaded to her electronic medical record. And from that point on, any physician in our network who needed them could view Mary's record, and it is secure. They could learn about her past medical.
Could we point out that there's no such thing as a dumb question in this discussion? Okay.
Yeah.
How did she have the electronic records? Many Americans do not. Is that true?
Yeah. It is true.
Go ahead.
Actually, many Americans have a chart that's very much like this chart. And you all might have seen a chart like this because it's probably your own. Or not your own, but you may have one like that.
So Mary was fortunate that she happened to have her records electronically.
That's
where there's a very large number of Americans who do not have their records in that fashion so that you could and others have access.
That's right.
All right.
And we can learn her past medical history and her past surgical history, her medicines and her allergies. And all of this helps us to become more efficient and provide better care for our patients. In terms of efficiency, though, let me show you another thing that you might have seen. This is a film jacket with x-rays. And does anyone have any idea how long it may take to go through these films and put them up on an imaging center and find that one image that we're looking for to discuss with our patients? Well, fortunately, with this technology, we no longer have to do that. Today, we have an image system known as PACS, and that stands for Patient Archive Communication System. And it allows us to view Mary's images right here across the internet, wherever we can establish an internet connection. It's allowed me to instantly view the status of Mary's tumor while she's on chemotherapy. And as you can see,
the x-ray is automatically transmitted.
Yes, sir.
It never goes into a old style.
It does not have to do that anymore. And when Mary was diagnosed with ovarian cancer in November, we were able to view her images in the operating room as well as afterwards and see how she has responded. And I do have some good news to share with everyone and with Senator McCain. If we look together, you can see there's a 4-millimeter area by a 22.9-millimeter area of disease which is left. Before, this was over 4 centimeters, and she had a large amount of disease in her pelvis. Today, this is the disease spot that's left in Mary, which tells us that means that after 6 cycles of chemotherapy, with the last one being 1 week ago, Mary's tumor has thankfully become smaller. The chemotherapy, which is part of an NCI-sponsored GOG clinical trial that we're lucky to have here at Lehigh Valley Hospital, is effectively shrinking Mary's tumor. Please join me again in giving Mary a warm round of applause. Let me show you how some other technologies have helped Mary. When I rounded with residents like Dr. Fonda Campbell after surgery, who's one of our OBGYN residents, and Mary told us that she needed pain medication, we entered that order directly into a handheld life book, like the one she's holding right here. Mary's request was processed immediately, and on its way to her, before we even left the floor. This particular technology is known as CAPO, Computer-Assisted Physician Order Entry. Now, we doctors realize that our handwriting may not be the best. When I was a resident, we wrote our orders in the patient charts, and we would only hope that our nurses would be able to interpret and read our handwriting. CAPO helps us to eliminate this problem. Essentially, we can put our orders in, and they're transmitted electronically. What it has done, it has removed our handwriting ability, and now things are entered electronically. Now, residents like Dr. Campbell look for these technologies when they choose where to go for their graduate medical education, and we are sure lucky to have Dr. Campbell training with us here. We are among the fewer than 10% of hospitals nationwide with 100% CAPO compliance. That means that all of the physicians on our staff here are using CAPO. To make sure...
And there's no paper.
Excuse me?
There's no paper.
Not with physician order entry. Nope, not with physician order entry. To make sure Mary receives the right dose of the right medication at the right time, we use barcoding technology, just like the one you may see in the supermarket. Our nurses work on computers with wheels like this mobile unit right here, and they scan the medication with Mary's wristband, with the medication, to assure it's a perfect match. This allows our nurses to spend more time caring for each patient at the bedside, and it is just another reason why our nurses have achieved magnet recognition year after year.
What? What has been the result in the percentage of medical errors?
All of this technology has reduced our medical errors by 80%, which is tremendous. We have eliminated legibility and transcription errors. That means we're giving the most appropriate care and the safest care to Mary and all of the people we care for, both in our community as well as in the remote lying areas. What is most comforting to know as a physician here, and Mary might not have known this, was that while Mary was in our advanced intensive care unit, she was remotely monitored by our specialists throughout the night. It is nice to know again as a surgeon after long surgery that when we admit patients to our intensive care unit, that we've got eyes on them and we're taking good care of them. 20 years ago, Mary might have been in the hospital for several months after surgery like today, like this. But today, in 9 days, she's able to go home. She's teaching us all to live each day to its fullest, because life truly is a gift. Mary, thank you so much for sharing your story with us today.
Mary, would you like to say a couple of words?
I would like to thank Dr. Martino. I don't believe that I would be feeling as well as I am today if it wasn't for him and his staff and other doctors and nurses here at Lehigh Valley Hospital. As you saw him demonstrate, the technology helped in my survival after and my recovery after surgery, but it also continues in my quality of life as I continued chemotherapy and testing here. I am confident that this is the place to be for me, and the combination of the quality that I get from here and the advancement in the technology, that my family and I will see me improving over the years, and I thank them for that.
I have. What has been the effect on costs of this kind of technology as opposed to the old way of doing business with the with the stacks of records and the pictures and what has been that effect?
As you can imagine, when we have images like this, and these images are stored in a certain hospital, and they're not universally accessible, then physicians can order multiple images at multiple points in the system. And if a patient presented to one hospital, they may get a CAT scan of the chest, abdomen, pelvis. And then the next week, the doctor may not know that they had that, and they can order another one. So now with having this centralized, we're able to order only one test, and all the doctors are speaking off the same record.
So that's bound to be significant, on costs must be dramatic.
It's tremendous. And I've been at certain places where when we go back and look at patients' records, there's over 15 images and CAT scans ordered in 1 year. Here, with what this PAC system, that wouldn't happen. So it definitely, I think, reduces costs.
And each CAT scan is an expensive procedure.
Yes, sir.
You don't know.
Sorry for the dumb questions.
keep them coming. What you don't know is I was a high school teacher before I was a doctor, so I've got to do a summary here, okay?
All right.
We've got barcoding. We've got PACS. That's the picture for archive system. The images that we have, as you have heard, we have physician order entry. And so these are some of the building blocks that are the foundation for our delivery of care to our patients. Mary is from Carbondale up near Scranton, and if you'll follow me, we're going to go over to this station, and you can see how we use technology to help with our high-risk pregnancy patients.
Thank you, Mary. Thank you, Dr. Kim. Thank
you. We've now gone to Wilkes-Barre, and we're looking in on an exam room in Wilkes-Barre, and this is Rochelle Rignisi, and she is an ultrasound technician and does ultrasounds on pregnant patients there. With her is Jennifer Hannon, and in her arms is Ellie, her 3-month-old.
Hey, Ellie.
So let me briefly tell you why we're telling you that, sharing this story with you. Last May, Jennifer learned she was pregnant. A joyful event for all of us, any of us. Unfortunately, that also brought some trepidation to Jennifer's family because she had previously lost 2 children to miscarriage because of some blood clotting disorders. This made her pregnancy a complicated one, and so we needed to involve physicians who deal with high-risk pregnancy in her care, and those were not available in her community. So we were able to provide the technology to basically transport some of that care to her and keep her so that you can see the product of this 3-month-old Ellie in her arms. I'd like to introduce you to her specialist, her high-risk pregnancy specialist, a perinatologist or maternal fetal medicine physician. This is Meredith Rochon. With her is Mr. Joe Tracy. He's our vice president for telehealth, former president of the American Telehealth Association, and has testified many times before Congress on telehealth issues. He'll talk to us a little bit later about the technology.
Good afternoon, John. Good afternoon, Senator McCain. Hi, Jennifer. Hi, Ellie. As Ron said,
have
Jennifer...
Have you ever met them personally?
I have, actually. I have, I have fortunately performed several procedures on Jennifer, and we had a very successful result.
Wonderful.
As Ron said, Jennifer has a clotting disorder, and her 2 previous pregnancies resulted in miscarriage. To decrease the chance of that happening again, Jennifer was treated with a blood-thinning medication this pregnancy and followed closely with frequent ultrasounds and blood work. At 20 weeks, we noted on one of those ultrasounds an additional complication for Jennifer, and that was that her cervix, which is the opening of her uterus, was starting to open and become shorter, significantly increasing her chance of losing this pregnancy. Now, 20 weeks is only 4.5 months, too early for the baby to survive on the outside. To try and prevent that from happening, Jennifer came down here to Lehigh Valley Hospital and had an emergency procedure called a cerclage, which put a stitch in her cervix to try and stop the process. Fortunately, that was successful, and after a few days, Jennifer was able to return home, but placed on bed rest for the remainder of her pregnancy, which we hoped would be 5 months. Now, Jennifer lives more than an hour from here, and so it was very difficult for her to be on bed rest and travel more than an hour for each of her visits. To continue giving her the care that she needed, closer to her home, we coordinated her care through Montage Center for Specialized Medicine, which is located in Moosic, Pennsylvania, about an hour and 15 minutes from here. through our PAC system, which Dr. Martino just showed you, Jennifer was able to continue to have her ultrasounds, and we, her physicians, more than 70 miles away, were able to view those pictures. Montage further has the technology that if we find something unexpected, we can discuss it with the patient face-to-face via televideo. And I can also watch the ultrasounds in real time and direct Michelle, our sonographer, to show me any special images that I may need to make the appropriate evaluation. We followed Jennifer and Ellie's progress very carefully during this pregnancy. One of those ultrasounds was very special, wasn't it, Jennifer?
Yes, it was. It was an ultrasound that I had up here at Montage when I was 26 weeks pregnant. I'm sorry if I might cry, but that was the first time that my husband and I were able to see our daughter's face.
obviously.
When that picture came up on the screen, we were in awe. We were so amazed. And I carried that picture around with me for a long time. It was so reassuring to be able to see her face. And the picture that you see up there on the screen, she still looks like that today. She still holds her little hand. So it was really amazing to have that picture. If it wasn't for Lehigh Valley Hospital and Health Network and care of people like Dr. Rashawn and Michelle, we wouldn't have a baby today. So we'll always be grateful for that. Our family will always be grateful for that. So thank you.
Wonderful story.
Michelle?
As Dr. Rashawn stated, if Jennifer were pregnant today, we'd be able to provide an even higher level of care through the telemedicine network. And what that does mean is the maternal fetal medicine specialist can interact with the obstetricians through a telemedicine network to provide a consultation and a real-time ultrasound examination to make it more convenient for mom and baby. I personally have had the experience of having a high-risk pregnancy, which had an unfortunate and tragic outcome. During my pregnancy, I had to travel to several different facilities, even as far as 2.5 hours away, to get my final diagnosis. This telemedicine technology probably could have facilitated my care a little bit quicker and sent me to a tertiary care. Because of this, I appreciate the telemedicine technology, and I'm sure that by offering this telemedicine service, it will help the specialists bring more happy babies like Ellie into the world.
Thank you, Michelle.
You're welcome.
So, we're talking about cost savings just from travel alone that is remarkable. Plus the access to the best minds that is available.
Care that's not available locally in their community, correct?
Thank you, Michelle. Thank you very much. Jennifer, thank you.
Thank
beautiful.
You.
Elliot, beautiful. Thank you.
Joe. You mentioned the access part, and that's kind of what this is all about. And this is kind of just one example of what we can do for maternal fetal medicine patients as well as other types of patients. And I kind of took a look at some of the cost factors. And when we use this kind of technology to deliver healthy, normal babies like Ellie, the costs kind of go way down. Because a baby that stays in a neonatal intensive care unit as a premature birth can spend a lot more time than a normal newborn, and the cost is usually about 20 times the cost of a normal newborn. So when we can use technology like this to promote that level of access, good outcomes, I think we lower the cost greatly.
Thank you.
Thank you, Michelle. Jennifer.
Thank you, Michelle.
Ellie,
Jennifer.
Joe.
Ellie.
Meredith.
Be sure to vote. Thank you.
I think Ellie has a present for you.
Thanks.
Let's all throw Ellie a kiss back, what do you say?
Thank you. That's very touching. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks. It's a wonderful story. Thanks, Jim. Thank you so much.
Come on over here. We'll have our third and final example for you. Our patient here is Martha Hodling, there in the middle. We've now gone to Bushkill, Pennsylvania, which is up in the Pocono Mountains. And about 3 years ago, she developed a severe case of influenza. As you know, that can be a fatal disease, and she was unconscious in her bathroom and was brought emergently down to our intensive care, and through the use of our technologies, pulled her through what was a very, very serious illness. The team that helped her were Dr. Matthew McCambridge, one of our critical care physicians, and Kathy Baker, one of the nurses that works with him. We'll hear from both of them.
Could I just ask, was this sudden?
It was very sudden. It started with like a light cold on a Wednesday. I was in the doctor's office by Friday, and I was in the ER by Saturday about 6 o'clock in the morning. So it did happen very rapidly.
Senator, at the Lehigh Valley Hospital, we have 988 beds, and 140 of those beds are intensive care unit beds. We have six ICUs here at the Cedar Crest site and another one across town on our Muhlenberg campus. We also monitor 18 beds at the Good Shepherd Hospital, which is across town. And all 140 of those critically ill patients are monitored all night long from 7 o'clock at night till 7 o'clock in the morning using something called an advanced ICU. And the advanced ICU is a physician and two nurses monitoring all 140 patients. And it's true that Martha was very critically ill when she came to see
us. That's not a lot of people to monitor that many patients.
Well,
that, you would be almost one-on-one.
Right. Well, without this type of technology, this type of technology allows us to monitor all those patients at the same time, because what we have is a monitoring system where I monitor all 140 patients would be listed here, and then I set the monitors to tell me when their white cell count, their laboratories are abnormal, or their heart rate, or their urine output. And then I'm sitting there with two nurses who screen through all these alarms, and then we can go to the patient's bedside. We have two-way video, and two-way audio, so I can go into every room, whether it's here at Cedar Crest or across town at Muhlenberg or at the Good Shepherd Hospital. We use an ICU electronic medical record, which is, we used to put everything on paper, but now the information is fed to the patient from the patient wirelessly from the room to us across town. This room is actually 4 miles from here. And you can see their heart rate, their blood pressure, their temperature, what type of ventilator they're on. So if a nurse calls us from the room, we can pull up all the information on the patient before we even go into the room. With the electronic medical record, we can look at their old transcriptions, we can look at all of their x-rays, and we're monitoring all 140 patients at the same time, again, from 7 at night till 7 in the morning when things can happen.
There's no such thing as a dumb question.
No.
What's the warning that...
You can see
sitting there, and there's 140
right.
people. Well, how do you know when there's something wrong?
Well, we'll see. You can see the warnings. They'll have a six warning. They're categorized as 1 through 6, and a 4 would be an elevated glucose, which is 250, which is too high. We would take care of that. But a really bad abnormality is this one here. A critical is a potassium 2.7.
What does that mean?
That's fairly low. If we don't take care of that quickly, then something potentially bad could happen to the patient. So the old model of practicing medicine would be the nurse would get that lab. It might take an hour to get to the nurse's bedside. She would try to call a doctor at home who's sleeping, wake him up and say, I have a potassium of 2.7 on a person in this room. What do you want to do about it? But now, since we're monitoring all the patients at the same time, we're getting real-time data, we can act immediately on all this information. And we can go in and actually talk to the patient and their families at the bedside and tell them what's going on. So when Martha came to
us... Which is one of the most important parts for the family.
The families absolutely love this technology. Initially, when we did this 4 years ago, we didn't know how it would be received, but now the families wait for us to come at 7 o'clock at night to get their update on their family. We talked to Martha's mom quite a few times through the camera. There's Martha's mom. This whole thing was built by just an amazing number of people at our hospital. Our chief information officer, Harry Lukens, right here. Don Levick is sitting behind us. He's our medical doctor who controls helps us with IS. And then there's so many people in the room. I don't want to say any more names or else I'm going to get in trouble. But they helped me. I just sit down at night and turn this on, and it miraculously works.
What am I looking at here?
Oh, that's a spine. I wish it was an X-ray, because I know a whole lot more about X-rays than spines. Mm. But that's a spine.
That's the PAC system that's available to them also there.
The digital X-rays.
Yeah.
Ed.
So... when Martha came to us, it's true that she was very critically ill. She came about 8 o'clock at night. She got emergently intubated and placed on life support. Within the first 24 hours, we did about 150 things to try to keep her with us, including not only the life support, but we put a heart catheter in her. We had to do a number of surgeries on her arms to relieve deadly pressure. And this was all being supervised by the advanced ICU, this telemedicine system. And I think you can see that she spent about 5 weeks with us. She spent about, they could only keep her in rehab for about 5 days because she wanted to get out of there. And then about 8 months later, she was dancing at her wedding. So we were
wonderful, Mark.
So
wonderful.
Happy.
You saw little Ellie there, didn't you?
I didn't get that far.
Could I ask what that is?
That's a heart catheterization. That's another type of digital image where we could look at the patient's heart catheterization, see if they have blockages. We can get echocardiograms. We don't use paper anymore. Everything is put right on the computer for us. In the middle of the night, I can look at all this information. And now I'd like to introduce you to...
Could I just ask again, and maybe our technology... my understanding is three people that are monitoring 140 patients.
Right.
Before you put your information technology in, how many people would that be?
I don't know. It usually takes about 12, one doctor for 12 patients. The reason we came up with this technology, sir, is that what I do for a living, I'm an intensive care unit doctor, and there's only 6,000 of them in America. It sounds like a big number, but for 300 million people, it's not a lot. And we're blessed to have a number of intensivists here. Dr. Riley, one of our trauma doctors, is here. We have 16 of them here at this hospital, but other communities don't even have one. So we use this technology to view ICUs where they don't have intensive care unit doctors. So,
how long did it take?
It took us about 3 years to develop that package that you see. That's 8 different systems tied together. Absolutely the coolest thing I've ever done.
And what was your model, Harry?
Pardon me?
What was your model? Where did you get this?
We actually didn't have a model.
We knew what the docs wanted. And we looked for a primary system to give Matt the ICU information. And then as we built that, then we'd say, so what else we need here, Matt? And he'd say, the PAC system, the emergency room system, the EMR. So we would constantly build on that. There really isn't a system like this in the country.
Are others imitating?
Absolutely.
Well, we've had 125 tours to date. We've had tours from Australia. We had a tour last month from the Canary Islands, which was a very interesting tour all over. Initially, we were one of the first people in the country to have this, and it was very interesting when we had places like Harvard coming to see us, and they subsequently put something similar in like this. If I could, though, I'd like to introduce you to Kathy Baker, who's one of our nurses. She's my partner in crime in this whole project.
I'm here representing the nurses who utilize this technology and benefit from it.
That's a nurse lobby.
Yeah. As Matt told you, we monitor over 140 patients from 7 p.m. to 7 a.m., and this is above the care that's at the bedside. So we're a supplement, we're a help, we're another pair of eyes. So there isn't a nurse who doesn't have access to an intensivist-led critical care team in this institution. There isn't a family who can't speak to a physician, and there isn't a patient who doesn't have this extra set of eyes watching their care. In fact, everyone benefits from this program.
How long have you been in the profession?
32 years.
Thank you.
And I was a night nurse for 20 years, so I really could understand how this could help.
Could I just ask, did you ever believe that something like this would be available to you?
No. As soon as they had the idea and Harry Lukin's team and Pulmonary Associates said, this is something we're thinking about, it just rang true for me as a nurse who had worked nights and needed to call physicians and trying to tell the story over and over and over again on the phone. We don't have to do that anymore. We just call. We call it the box. We call the box, and the doc, he's seeing exactly what we're seeing at the bedside. So there's this, you know, an early development of a plan and care. So it's a continuity of care.
So it really played a role in Martha's...
Yes. Martha is just a great example of what really can be done, and she can really attest to our capabilities.
I am in awe of how far I've come, all the technology that has come about. And I'm here, I'm a living testament to what's going on here. You know, I'm able to do all the things that I love, like go horseback riding, spend time with my family, my husband, you know, anything that I can imagine. And I was able to dance at my own wedding. I was able to walk on down the aisle, and I had a lot of fun. I can't thank all my caregivers, especially Dr. McCambridge, Dr. Matchett, and Kathy, I'm sorry. And it was just an amazing period of time. I don't remember a lot about being in the teleintensive unit, but my mom did tell me that they were able to keep in contact with both my mom and dad and keep them abreast of all the information that they needed about my health care.
Could I, Mom? Could you just... I'm sorry to take up the time, but tell us about how important it was for you to get these briefings and updates.
It was very important because one minute they said they had to cut her arms. Next minute they had to do something else. And when they said they wanted to do a heart transplant on her, it was crazy.
And you were kept up
abreast.
To date literally
yes.
Hour by hour.
I used to talk to a doctor at McCambridge, called him Doc in a Box.
Well, do you approve of your son-in-law?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, good. Thank you. Thank you, Mom. Thank you, Martha.
Thanks, Matt, Martha, Kathy. Speaking of lobbies, there is no additional reimbursement for this technology that we use. It's value added because it's the right thing to do for patients.
But the initial investment must have been...
was several millions. Harry, do you know the answer to that?
It was about $4.5 million.
Okay. And where did the funds come from?
You know, we are, like most hospitals in America, a community-owned, not-for-profit institution. That doesn't mean, though, that we can avoid generating a surplus every year. We do that, and the reason we do that is to invest in projects like this that, in fact, provide better care for our patients. I don't think Martha would be with us if we didn't have the doc in the box, as corny as it sounds.
Could I ask both of you again to comment on the cost issues as to savings? You've both been in the business for a long time. And the reason why I keep coming back to this, in all respect, and I think the vital part is saving lives, which you've done so magnificently, but it's also getting our costs under control and reducing health care costs so it can be available and affordable. What has been the overall impact of this on your overall costs of doing business?
Well, I think if we talk about our overall costs of doing business in the ICU, we've seen that compared to what it would have been, this is clearly less. Let me give you one specific example. By having this type technology, for example, no longer having nurses write things on paper and worried about those big paper sheets, we can see in an average 12-hour shift, nurses have 90 more minutes at the bedside. Now, there would be a choice. We could theoretically use fewer nurses. We don't make decisions that way. We use our nurses then to provide more care for patients, meaning the quality of their care gets better, the communications with family members are more often. I would say to you the following. I do think that good health care is expensive, but you're absolutely right that there are lots of opportunities in healthcare to get actually higher quality and get it at lower cost, and that's the mission we're on for our community.
And so it's hard to calculate that because of this incredibly increased efficiency of treatment, it's hard to calculate what the cost might be with a sicker patient that takes longer to cure, to the increased personnel costs. You probably can figure the increased personnel costs, but the additional cost of the old type of care is hard to calculate, but clearly a major factor here. Is that?
That is true. Perhaps another way to approach this question is if we look at ourselves compared to similar institutions. In fact, our quality measures are at the upper point, let's say the 90th percentile, meaning we're at least better than 90% of those, and our costs are down at the 30th or lower percentile. So with all this technology, we're in a high-quality, relatively low-cost position. And good health care is expensive. It's not going to be free, but yes, we can all do somewhat better. We need lots of help to get that done, like funding systems like this, no question. And because, you know, Ron has his lobby, I'll stick with the nurse lobby. That's a powerful lobby.
I guess finally, because I know that there are questions from the audience, the medical error situation obviously is one that not only serious because of its effect, but the confidence of the patient and the community. Maybe you could just talk a little bit about that, because a lot of places I've been, medical errors have literally had obviously significant damage.
Well, I would briefly say that medicine, nursing, all those caring professions are about people. And when we have people involved, we will have errors. People don't go into medicine, nursing to make mistakes, but they're inevitable. They're part of who we are. What you've seen today is how can we build a better system that, in fact, reduces those errors? And clearly there are ways to do that. When we heard that Dr. Martino said our error rate was decreased by 80%, we started from a very, very low number. We're now down to less than one error per 100,000. So we're getting pretty darn good. But it is by employing this technology, and this technology can, again, as you've pointed out, raise quality because fewer medical errors are higher quality and reduce cost. When patients get sick inadvertently because of things that are unfortunate but occur in terms of a medical error, that costs to society, to the patient, and to the people who are paying the bills. No question about that.
Well, I thank you, and I thank you for this briefing. It's been very impressive and very touching, and I'm very grateful, and I appreciate it. I'd just like to make one additional comment that has impacted me, because I come from a state where we have large populations centered in two major cities, and we have, believe it or not, large rural areas. And one of those areas, my friends, is our Indian reservations, our Native Americans. And I think it's just a fact of life that because of the light population, we would probably never have facilities built there, certainly not sufficient numbers. This is already being employed, but not anything near what I think the potential that it holds for rural America, and in particularly our Native American reservations. And so I'm going to go back more motivated and talk to the Indian Health Service to try to get them to come here and have one at your 500th briefing or tour to maybe, because we do have an obligation that we're entering into a solemn treaty with our Native Americans, and one of them was to provide them with health care, and we haven't done that. And this may be, I think, a big part of the of meeting that obligation.
We'd love to help.
Thank you. So. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
I know that we're all particularly grateful to our caregivers and to the patients and their families who have been so gracious in sharing their stories. I would say we've been lucky here at Lehigh Valley Hospital to get some national recognition for these efforts. We're on the 100 most wired lists of all hospitals, the 25 most wireless lists, and that recognition is nice. But at the end of the day, as you said earlier, it is about how our doctors and our nurses use this technology to care for our patients. And that's what it's really all about. And thank you for recognizing that. I think now we're going to have a chance to turn things over to you. There are going to be, I'm sure, lots of questions from our audience who would like to probe a little bit more deeply in terms of what we can expect in terms of healthcare in the future and how we use technology.
Thank you, sir. And if you just raise your hand if you have a question or comment, and we have people here with microphones. Yes, sir. I think there's a microphone over there.
Hello, Senator. Thank you for coming. My name is Luke Savage. I work in the Information Services Department, and I help support some of the stuff you've seen today. Given that most technologies that we've seen here and a lot of the technology and therapy that underpins the medical industry begins with research at academic institutions or research in hospitals like this, I just want to ask, what's going to happen to the funding for research programs in universities across the nation, be it, you know, a new technology or a new sort of cell therapy, if you are elected president?
I think obviously we have to encourage it and we have to fund it. But it brings up a larger issue, if I could share with you for a minute. And by the way, you don't have to give back the microphone until I am confident that you are satisfied with my response. You know, one of the things about these gatherings is it's one thing for you to stand up and ask a question, and then I give you an answer that may not satisfy the question that you have. So I'd like to have you hang on the microphone. I'm sure that I'll totally satisfy whatever. But I think we need to fund it, and I think we need this to be this incredible technology and what they're doing at Miami Children's Hospital and what they're doing at the Moffitt Institute. And we've got to knit all that together. But one of the problems I see in Washington today is there's a competition, and I think Dr. Sussman would agree with me. There's a competition for funds, which sometimes is dependent upon the political influence of the groups or individuals or cause or technology that they want funded, as opposed to, frankly, a objective view. And there's never enough money. We know there's never enough money to fund cancer research. There's never enough money to do these things. So rather than have it decided, in all due respect by my colleagues in Congress, I'd like to see a group of Americans appointed by the president who are the best in their business, whether it be doctors, whether it be nurses, whether it be the technicians, the ones who know about the technology, and objective scientific opinion and knowledge, so that they can say, okay, here's our first priority for funding, here's our second, here's our third, here's our fourth. One, it would save people a lot of travel expense back and forth to our nation's capital, but more importantly, I think that all of us could be better served in the funding and the much-needed research, treatment, information technology, by getting the smartest people in America together and have them make the recommendations. Now, maybe Congress wouldn't always follow those recommendations, but at least we'd have a basis for our funding, rather than people literally coming to Washington with their hand out and trying to have precedence or priority over other much-needed funding as well for other causes. Do you see my point?
Yes, I do, and I count myself as a researcher who lost their funding, so I understand what you're saying about the way that it would change, and I think that.
And I think maybe you would have been satisfied more if you knew that there was a most qualified people in America to make judgments that were recommending that you not receive that funding, rather than a process that, frankly, is opaque at best.
Yes, I agree. I think that would be an excellent change.
Thank you. Goodbye. Oh, yes, sir.
Senator, my name is Ray Singer. I'm a heart and lung surgeon here at Lehigh Valley Hospital. One of the cost drivers are physicians who feel they have to practice defensive medicine. When you look at the three major candidates running for president, you seem to be the only one addressing national liability reform. Could you share that with us today?
Yes, sir. I don't have to ask any physician in this room exactly how many procedures or tests that may not be absolutely necessary that are administered to patients that are good to know the results, but perhaps the primary reason is for the fear or concern about finding themselves in court. And I think clinical guidelines are very, very important. And I believe that any physician who can prove to anybody's satisfaction that they adhered to those guidelines, then they should have some protection from frivolous lawsuit. And I believe also that if we don't have reform of this very litigious situation we have in America, that it's going to be increasingly difficult for us to reduce the overall cost of health care. And I don't have to tell you, I'm obviously almost insulting your intelligence and experience, but my friends, the cost of insurance of physicians today, particularly in some specialties, is staggering. It's staggering. And in some states, it literally drives physicians in certain specialties out of those states. And that's not right. That's not right. People in America should have access or an availability to the best health care. And I wonder if that's too strongly stated.
No, we certainly agree, and it also drives people out of certain specialties, not just locations. In my own specialty in cardiac surgery, only 60 students went into training programs in 2007 in the entire country. 50% of all heart surgeons are going to be retired in the next 10 years, or 55 years and up. So this could be a real problem as the baby boomers get older. And I think one of the reasons is, on top of a stressful field being under the microscope, and liability concerns are real.
And in conversations with doctors who have a choice of what their specialty is, that's one of their concerns?
There's no doubt when you talk to medical students today, students are avoiding high-risk fields.
Well, I just want to assure you that that reform will be one of my agenda items if we're truly going to address seriously the problem of escalating costs of health care in America.
Thank you.
Thank you. Hi, Senator McCain. My name is Katrina Fritz. I'm a nurse here. I work in cardiac quality. And in light of what Dr. Singer just said, which is very true, two-part question. How do you feel about preventive care? Because honestly, that's what keeps us from getting into those problems. And if you would not become the president, how would you feel about expressing those viewpoints that you have that are very good? I've heard you talk, and I agree a lot with what you said. How would you work with whoever became the president?
Thank you. Let me just by beginning to state the obvious that our friends in the healthcare profession know, and one of the most alarming statistics in America today is the increase in obesity, high blood pressure, and diabetes amongst young Americans. There's no healthcare system in the world that can sustain the costs of a continued increase that in those, just those three aspects of America's health, it's impossible to reduce the cost of health care in America if that's the case. But more importantly, we are, as we have seen through many, many years and maybe centuries, an increase in the lifespan of Americans that could level off because of the health and wellness of another generation of Americans. I would like to see everything ranging from insurance companies rewarding their clients for wellness and fitness to employers rewarding their employees. If they join a health club, they would pay their dues. The insurance companies would give reduced premiums to people who obviously have displayed wellness and fitness, etc., so that there's incentives financially. But also, I'd love to see, and I know that this is a little utopian, but I know that young Americans like and admire and respect me, those that know me, at least I hope that most of them do. But the people they really look up to in America are our great athletes. And I'd love to see my friend Shaquille O'Neal, who just finished the playoffs last night, as the Phoenix Suns were defeated by the San Antonio Spurs again, he inaugurated a program in Miami when he was a member of the Miami Heat, and it was called Shaq's Challenge. And I had at my own Miami Children's Hospital a chance to meet a young man who had lost 76 pounds, who had taken up Shaq's Challenge. And by exercise and by dieting, this young man was in good health today. Now, in all due respect to my prestige and influence, I'm not sure he would have taken up Mac's Challenge. you see what I mean? So I'd love to see our great athletes, who young Americans, and women athletes that young women look up to and admire, and all people that are admired by young people, to go around to the schools in America and talk to them and try to motivate them, and that we lay out programs that they can follow and give them diets that they can follow. And I understand the other thing I'd like to have parents do is go to their school and find out what's in the school lunch program. And I'd also like to have parents and school board members find out what the physical education requirements are or program is in schools in America today. But for older Americans that are out of school, then I think we've got to put in specific incentives for people to practice wellness and fitness. And I just want to add one other point. I'm sorry for over-answering, but I really believe that this is one of the crucial aspects of providing available and affordable health care to all Americans, and that's smoking. My friends, I smoked for a long time. It used to be the thing that Navy pilots did. It was part of our sort of image. I'm happy to say I quit many years ago. I'm also unhappy to tell you I still want a cigarette, but I haven't had one in 20 some years since I've had one. But smoking is really, really unfortunate, especially with some young Americans on the rise. And we have taxes on cigarettes, as you know, today. And that money, instead of going to programs to disincentivize young Americans to smoke and treatment of tobacco-related illnesses, it's going into general revenues. And it was supposed to be going, the tax that's paid on a pack of cigarettes was supposed to be going to these programs, and it's not. And I think we should demand that it be so. And they have proven in some states where there is active anti-tobacco use programs, that they've been successful. They've been successful. So it's not a question of whether they work or not. It's whether we're going to devote those funds, which are specifically imposed on the sale of tobacco products, to be devoted to those programs, including the treatment of tobacco-related illnesses. So wellness and fitness, wellness and fitness. Yes, sir.
Thank you for coming, Senator. My name is Jim Riley. I'm one of the trauma surgeons here. And you mentioned earlier the need to make objective decisions with respect to health care. And
so funding for research, especially.
Or even policymaking.
Yes, sir.
My question is really about objectivity. And every time I see a debate on health care, I really wonder whether or not the statistics and the data that people are discussing are accurate, reliable. And it's pretty easy to put something on the table and have somebody else take it off as a statistic that will refute any other statistic. And so are you satisfied with the information that you're getting in terms of its ability to allow competent decision making?
I think on the major statistics, I am. And here's the most disturbing fact of all, and I don't think it's disputed. 47 million Americans are without health insurance today. Half of them will probably it's because they're out of a job and they will gain employment and then they will then be able to obtain health insurance. And that's nice to know. But the other half, which I, 8 million are children, then they, and many of those children, of course, it's just because we haven't been around to sign them up. But then you get down into what you and I all know is with a big looming fiscal problem and challenge, and that is the those with chronic diseases or pre-existing and or pre-existing condition. And that's the area where we really need to address, because they won't, the insurers won't insure them. They're either making too much money to qualify for Medicaid or other reasons. Like, as I mentioned, there are some children that simply aren't in the SCHIP program just because they haven't been signed up for it. But there is that group of Americans that with pre-existing conditions and with chronic diseases, and as you know, there are five that consume 75% of the health care costs in America, where we're going to have to sit down with the governors and the legislatures and the health care providers and the patients and come up with a way of providing them access to health care in America. There's 21 states, I think, now that are that have placed restrictions on premiums and other things. There's a number of other states that are working on risk pools and providing the ability for, or not the ability, but facilitating a system where these people can be treated. The governor of Florida has a proposal called Cover Florida, but that's a major challenge that we face. And I think we can do it working with the governors and the legislatures, sitting down and having them fund, but also in the way that the federal government can also provide that care. So my answer to you is I think that a lot of the, some of the statistics may be not accurate, but the issue of the uninsured and those with pre-existing conditions or chronic diseases is really a, particularly the pre-existing conditions, is one that that's the major challenge in healthcare in America today. Yes, ma'am. Yes, sir.
Hi, Senator McCain. My name is Neil Coker. I'm a ED nurse at the Cedar Crest site here. I was on the when I was coming into work today, I heard on the radio that a high government official said that Medicare was going to be broke in a few years. And my question to you is, when you become president, well, what will you do to overhaul Medicare?
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for the question. Secretary of Health and Human Services, former Governor Leavitt of Utah, gave a speech yesterday, I believe it was, and I have gotten a copy of it and hadn't had a chance to read it, where he basically talked about the fact that Medicare is going broke. And Americans need straight talk. Americans need straight talk. And that is that the Medicare system in America is not going to be there for the next generation of Americans. And we have an obligation. We have an absolute obligation not to pass on that that unacceptable situation to the next generation of Americans. And we're going to have to sit down together, and we're going to have to work it out so that we can get healthcare, Medicare, for succeeding generations of Americans who are now paying into the system, as you know. I believe that the key to this is not the quality of healthcare in America. If you forget everything I say today, let me emphasize to you this. The quality of healthcare in America is the best in the world. That's why when someone who lives in another country who gets ill, they come to the United States of America for treatment, and they the ones that can afford to do so. It's the cost of healthcare. It's the cost of healthcare that makes it not available to all Americans. And you see this directly affected in the skyrocketing cost of healthcare, which is then reflected in the skyrocketing cost of Medicare and Medicaid. So we've got to get the costs under control, and that's why I sounded a little repetitive in our discussion about costs. And I think that to say we can't do anything about it ignores coming to this kind of caregiving and loving institution where they obviously not only give a higher quality of care with less errors and far more efficient and saving wonderful young people like Martha, but it also reduces the cost of health care because we cannot afford double-digit or near-double-digit escalation of health care costs in America. And we have to have more competition, more transparency, more walk-in clinics, more treatment of people who have a chronic disease. One of the five major diseases, if they have that, then you give the caregiver a certain amount of money for that treatment and care. And then at the end of a period of time, you reward that caregiver or not. You want to encourage home health care, which is a much more loving and caring setting than institutionalized care. You want to, I think, increase the availability of a thing called cash and counseling, a program where basically they provide patients with a certain amount of money and they pay for their caregiving themselves and make their decisions with their family and the help of outside people to give them the advice and counsel they need. Now, many people say that seniors can't do that, that this issue deserves. And I want to tell you right now, I will reach across the aisle to the Democrats and I will say, the other party, I will say, look, let's sit down together. Social Security is not going to be there for the next generation, and Medicare is not going to be there for the next generation. Now, we have to sit down together and do what the American people want us to do. And I guarantee you, it's been done before, and I can do it again. And I thank you for your question. Yes.
Good afternoon, Senator McCain. As a Vietnam veteran, welcome back.
Thank you.
I was in the 93rd evac.
Thank you for serving.
You're welcome. Thank you very much. As a nurse here, I'm one of the aging population of nurses. We are running into a shortage. What are you going to do to make the next generation make it affordable for a nurse to go into nursing and to want to and provide it as funds?
I think the same is true with other areas of the medical profession. I think we have to do a lot more to encourage young Americans to become doctors, nurses, all of the care providers, all of those individuals who are in our healthcare system, because quite often, in the name of economy, we deprive these individuals who are all part of the healthcare provider system from the income that they otherwise earn and deserve, particularly when you look at the hours that they work. We were just mentioning 12-hour shifts, standard for a nurse. So I think we need to offer incentives, and I think we need to do things like in exchange for service, whether it be on an Indian reservation or whether it be in the military or whether it be in other ways of public service, we should provide those incentives. But at the same time, I think we should make scholarships available and affordable. And I also think that there are times when we really have to provide greater rewards for entering into your profession. And I would be more than eager to hear your suggestions as how we can do that, because it is well known that there will be a shortage of nurses in America. It's just an undeniable fact. Go ahead, please.
At the present time, they are turning away people that would like to go into the profession because of the lack of educators and the lack of spaces at the colleges.
Well, I thank you for that information, and I would like for you to send me that information, and I'd like for you to tell me your recommendations as to how we can expand those opportunities. And I thank you for that information. Thank you. Could I go all the way in the back there and then up front and then?
Thank you very much. Can you hear me? My name is Michael Sullivan. I'm not a doctor. I'm not a nurse. I am very much a supporter of you. I have been for a very long time. My family is as well. my father was also a Vietnam vet. My question is directly correlated to the experiences I'm going through in my life at this point. In my support for you, I find, especially in this state, a lot of reservations. And in the things that I've been going through, like I said, at this point, I want to know, on behalf of all the people who have really taken very good care of me and gone out of their way to do so, what is being done about the funding sources for drug and alcohol treatment, which is the number one problem which is going on in society, and I'm sure, I'm not a doctor, like I said, but it's got to be leading to more than half of these problems, inevitably.
I thank you. I think that it is a enormous challenge, and the way to address it, the ways to address it range from stopping the, doing everything we can to stop the flow of illegal drugs across our border, to doing everything we can to maintain the family unit, to providing a quality education and training for young people in this country and displaced workers who have lost their jobs because of the flight of manufacturing jobs out of the state of Pennsylvania and Ohio and the heartland of America, to give them the re-education and training so that they won't feel the sense of desperation that leads them to the use of prescription drugs as well as other illegal drug use. I think that obviously when people's economic situation deteriorates, then you see a rise in all of those difficulties and tragedy that strikes American citizens and the American family. I would do everything in my power to address the issue of methamphetamines, which is a serious problem in America. I think the fact that we've now taken some of these medicines and made them prescription drugs has helped some. But methamphetamines in some parts of America is a huge challenge. I don't think that there's any one answer, but it really does come back to giving Americans hope and optimism that they will inherit a better country than the one that they inherited. And right now, Americans are hurting in Pennsylvania and across this country. Tonight, a family will be sitting around the kitchen table figuring out how they can make their new increased mortgage payments. Some of them, 250-some thousand, will be sitting around the kitchen table and figuring out what they're going to do because they suddenly and recently lost a job. So we're going to have to grow our economy. We're going to have to provide education and training. We're going to have to provide opportunities, and we're going to have to take these steps in a way that's meaningful to the American people. The time for action is now. The time for change is now. But it has to be meaningful change. And I think that we could spend, frankly, days and weeks on the challenges that you faced. But I think a lot of it has to do with the socioeconomic underpinnings of families and neighborhoods in America. And we've got a lot of work to do. And we'll be having this discussion as in this upcoming campaign, because I think that's what this campaign is going to be all about, whether we will have meaningful hope and change for America or whether we will do business as usual. Did you want to follow up on that? I'd be glad to. If you've got a suggestion for me.
Just a very brief one, sir. Like I said, I very much admire you. You know, I'm living proof that it works. I'm living proof day by day. My family will tell you firsthand that I'm not the same person I was when I, you know, initially went through the things I went through. I have a bachelor's degree in elementary education. You know, I was an elementary school teacher before I got swept up in the wrong things. The bottom line is I know that there are more prisons being funded right now. There's more money going to the prisons, quite simply, than there is to these drug and alcohol treatment centers, which are saving people's lives. And
thank you.
That's all.
Could I just mention specifically on that issue? In our state of Arizona, first-time drug offenders, not dealers, but first-time drug offenders, have the opportunity to go through a very rigorous rehab program and stay out of prison. That, and it has to do with frequent testing, and it's a very rigorous program. but it works, and it keeps people, frankly, out of prisons. And I think one of your issues that you mentioned is, and I'm no liberal to say the least, but I do think first-time offenders ought to be given the opportunity to rehab rather than ending up in prison sometime, or many times they come out, frankly, worse off than they were before. Could I do just one more?
We've got time for one more question. Yes.
My name is Linda. I work in the patient accounting department and as a customer service representative. So I am kind of a liaison between services provided and insurance companies and patients and families calling on behalf of them. I happen to be a single mother, too. So whenever I see situations such as patients calling because they have high co-insurances, deductibles, co-pays, things like that, they want to express disappointment or you know, just being upset at the hospital. I believe that the health care costs are rising, not so much so because of providers, but more so because of insurance companies. And under your proposed health care resolution, how do you plan on having the insurance companies being held accountable for the fact that they're not reimbursing us the way that they should, and thus making their members have such high out-of-pocket responsibilities?
Thank you, Linda. Could I just say that one of the frustrations that Americans feel today, particularly those whose health insurance is provided by their employer, is they don't have a choice. It's the insurance that their employer provides to them. And sometimes they are very frustrated, as they've reflected in their comments to you. What I want to do is have Americans have a choice and be in charge, the families to be in charge of their health insurance choices. I want to give every family in America a $5,000 refundable tax credit that they can take and go across state lines, not just be confined here to the state of Pennsylvania. But if there's a better health insurance plan in Arizona, let them take it. You can do that with automobile insurance. And I believe that gives Americans a choice and a kind of a competition. Now, if they want to keep the insurance that their employer provides to them, fine. But I don't think the employer ought to I'm for abolishing the write-off for the employer to provide the health care by giving the employee the $5,000 tax credit, and that is more than enough to pay any taxes that might be associated with that benefit, and also gives them the choice if they want to go someplace else and choose the insurer of their choice. I believe that choice and competition are really the keys to, frankly, success in education in America, and certainly health care. And my friends, if you think the government should take over the health care system in America, please let me know how you feel after you go to the airport and go through screening. If you think there's efficiencies in government health care, I want to make health care affordable and available. I do not want a system of health care in America that we see in Canada and we see in other countries in the world where we have government health care system. And that's my commitment to make health insurance affordable and available, and that is by giving Americans more choice as to the kind of health insurance they need and best suits them and their family. I hope that responds to your question or comment, Linda. Thank you for all you do. Thank you for being here. It's been a great experience for me. Thank you very much, Doctor. Thank you very much.
Senator.